I'm the doctor, by the way.
You're listening to Pieces of Eight, a Doctor Who podcast that's got a lot of bite in its teeth.
Easy, tiger. Ooh, I'm sorry, I just was doing biting sounds and I bit my tongue. That wasn't very clever. Anyway, we are carrying on in our trip through those sections of the Doctor Who universe that feature the incarnation of the Time Lord, as played by Paul McGann. I'm Kenny Smith. Sorry, I forgot to introduce myself there.
And I'm Rebecca Chapman. You join us as we resume our quest to feature the Eighth Doctor's exploits, whether on screen, in books, novellas, full cast, audio, short stories, comics, animations, talking books, or anything else we can lay our eyes, ears, and hands upon. I had to take two breaths. That was disappointing.
You've been doing so well these past few days.
And today we're looking at the most recent Eighth Doctor BBC audiobook, following on from The Scent of Blood and The Code of Flesh, where the Doctor has met journalist James McFarlane in Edinburgh and Cardiff. But where next? Well, we're about to find out about their encounter in Antarctica. Kenny, what's the coldest you've ever been?
Oh, thank you. That's a good question. I think possibly in 2010, I think it was, when I got snowed into the office, because I went to work as normal in the morning, drove to work over the hill to Hamilton and parked up. Then the snow started to fall and it kept falling and falling. And I think it was about a foot and a half deep by the end. And I ended up having to sleep in the office that night because I couldn't get out. And then snow was everywhere. Then in the morning I went back to the car as soon as we got first light. So right, I'm going home, I'm knackered. I actually finished writing the paper, editing it, so the only thing left to do was the front page, and it was going to be a weather story. So I just told the guys, there you go, you write a weather story, I'm happy to sign it off, you're not stupid, go for it. And so I left them and went home, and I had to drive over the back. But yeah, getting snow off the car was horrendous because I didn't have any gloves or anything. It was just me and my suit. I didn't have a big overcoat, nothing like that. It was just so cold. And I remember my hands were up. I sat with the heating on and just sitting with my hands over the heat vents and just sort of defrosting. What about you?
I can't remember a time that I've ever been really cold.
Oh, you're lucky. You don't live in Scotland, yeah. It's quite clear.
I definitely do not live in Scotland.
No, but it was chilly, that one. Actually, I remember also that night, I think I got an issue of the fanzine, the finished product, done that night. It was our Sarah Jane Smith and I Davros issue. And I think I'd only got sort of like half of it done. So I ended up going through it and finishing it off. Although you can tell because I didn't proof it properly because I was so tired and just wanted to get it done. So there's quite a few typos, and even text runs off a page at one point and it doesn't finish a sentence. So bad Kenny of the past. That's why you don't rush these things. You take time. So there we go. Anyway, Becca, would you kindly tell us what the CD cover has to tell us about the Teeth of Ice?
Of course. My cold seems to have resurfaced, so I apologise for the sniffing and the coughing.
Oh no.
Really voiced attempt. Indomitable reporter James McFarlane has travelled to the remote MacReady base near the South Pole, his mission to interview the famed explorer Pentheus Rochdale. On arrival, McFarlane is astonished to discover that the base's new medical officer is none other than the Doctor. McFarlane is intrigued by rumours of strange goings-on at the base, whilst a recent attack on a neighbouring station, by creatures unknown, has attracted the Doctor's attention. The two friends focus on Rochdale's expedition to find the legendary lost continent of Mu, which he believes may lie in Antarctica. When a series of grisly deaths disturbs the base's calm, the Doctor's suspicions are aroused. Whatever is preying on people, it's intelligent and has deadly claws and teeth. But by the time he and McFarlane have uncovered the truth, they are well within biting distance of the Teeth of Ice.
Oh, that was good. Shall we hear a quick extract from the start of the story as the Doctor and James meet once again?
Indeed we should.
Here we go.
Room 20 was further down the corridor, around two corners, and was surprisingly bare. If the base medic did live here, then he seemed to have no personal possessions. Dumping his own stuff, and carefully brushing as much of the remaining snow as he could find from his boots, trousers and jacket, McFarlane made his way out and started searching for the medical bay. He realised he was probably going in the wrong direction when he heard barking ahead and smelled dogs. That would be the Husky Pens then, where they kept the Antarctic dogs used for pulling sledges. He turned around and went down a different corridor. The smell of food persuaded him that it led to the canteen, so he turned around again. Eventually, after several more false starts, he smelled liniment and surgical spirit. The medical bay. He knocked on the door. In a slow but somehow commanding tone of voice, someone inside called out.
Please tell me you've got something more than a strain, a break, or frostbite. Bubonic plague? Histronic radiation poisoning? Please, anything to break the monotony.
McFarlane pushed the door open, suddenly knowing exactly who he was going to see inside. Doctor. It wasn't even a question, merely an inevitability.
That's what it says on my medical degree, which, if memory serves, was taken either 8 or 800 years ago, but definitely in Edinburgh.
And thanks to Dan Starkey for personally recording that for us, because it's not at all the main reading. He did that. He remade it just for us. Becca, had you ever heard of the lost continent of Mu before? I hadn't.
No, I had not.
One of those ones along with Atlantis. It was discovered by, and I've just done a quick Google, Augustus Le Plongeon, which 1825 to 1908. The name was subsequently identified with the hypothetical land of Lemuria by James Churchward, who asserted it was located in the Pacific Ocean before its destruction. I have to say, there's quite a lot of lost continents. I think there's a whole one like down in New Zealand. It's called Zealandia, something like that. But I have looked into this because I found it quite an interesting phenomena when I...
Yeah, no, it is very interesting.
Of course, this is set in World War of Explorers and the Antarctic and the Arctic. And I mean, it's a fascinating time in the world when these things were going on. Are you interested in these sort of old expeditions and how these things went?
I am. I still am. I love that sort of thing. Ancient Egypt, the discovery of the pyramids at Egypt and all of just the general expeditions like Machu Picchu and the Aztec temples and all of these things. I find them absolutely fascinating. So,
yeah, I'm the same. I mean, particularly last year when it was announced that they'd found Shackleton's Endurance down in Antarctica and beautifully preserved underwater, and all this wonderful video footage of going around because it's just been perfectly preserved because the water's so pure and wow, love it.
And cold.
And cold, of course, yeah, it's frozen solid underwater pretty much. Yeah. So we've had vampires, we've had Frankenstein's monster type, now we've got werewolves. Are you a fan of werewolves in general?
I am. I like all of the kind of classic monster types, you know, werewolves, vampires, goblins, gremlins.
Hobgoblins?
Yeah. I like a hobgoblin too.
Who doesn't? Who doesn't enjoy a... No, I nearly made a smutty comment and I'm not going to say anything because that would just be rude. But yeah, something that I particularly like towards the end of this story is, of course, the Doctor and James have a fallout, but there's this wonderful image of a Victorian airship over Antarctica. I mean, just isn't that something that you could just imagine in a movie?
Oh, I know. Very easily.
I love it. I mean, for me, Andy's done it again. Another great story. The Doctor and James dynamic is fantastic. And all the little details that he's put in here about being an explorer, you know, with having to, about how you wrap up properly, kicking snow off your boots so that it doesn't, you know, get into your foot and melt so your foot's all wet. Then when you go back outside, you get frostbite and then your toes will fall off, etc. I mean, that kind of detail is fantastic and it makes you kind of glad that we live in an age where if I was mad enough to want to go exploring in Antarctica, I could get some proper survival gear and wouldn't need to worry about that sort of thing. So, yeah, I do like that level of research.
Definitely.
Yep.
It shows dedication.
Yes, it does. Dedication's what you need if you want to be a record breaker. No, you're too young for that. Anyway, let's find a little bit more about this story and how it came to be by having a chat with the executive producer for BBC Audio. It's Mr. Michael Stevens.
Hello, I'm Michael Stevens, Audio Commissioner for BBC Audiobooks Doctor Who range.
Welcome back to Pieces of Eighth, Michael, and we're chatting once again about another of your fantastic originals featuring the Eighth Doctor. So we spoke previously and you hinted that this was on the way, so here it is at last. So
yeah,
tell us a wee bit more about this arc, how you've been enjoying it.
Well, it started, of course, with Andy's story, The Scent of Blood, several years ago now, where he created this character of James McFarlane, the journalist in Victorian Edinburgh. And, you know, he had an initial adventure with the Eighth Doctor, which was delightful and was very well received. And I think Andy and I both thought James was an interesting character, and that he immediately seemed to hit it off with the Eighth Doctor in a very interesting way. Yeah, so that then led to The Code of Flesh, in which the Doctor encounters James in Cardiff, and subsequently the third encounter is The Teeth of Ice. And, you know, what's interesting is that James himself is always in his own timeline. So it's a case of, for some reason, which hasn't yet been explained and may never be explained, the Eighth Doctor keeps returning to this period in time. But the locations where he meets James differ. So first of all, we had Edinburgh, then we had Cardiff, and now the further flung location of the South Pole.
I have to admit that I was expecting it to be set in Belfast initially, but of course Andy told us last year that it would be a little further south than that. But I was expecting to ground the various capitals of the UK, but there we go.
Maybe Belfast will have its day one of these days.
But I mean, a thing that I've really enjoyed is sort of revisiting the classic horror tropes and the universal biggies from the horror films of the 30s. And I suppose that must be good fun for you as well, just to see how Andy puts a Doctor Who twist on them.
It is, yes, and that's entirely down to Andy. You know, it's his choice of monster for the Doctor to encounter. So it's as much of a surprise for me as it is for the audience, really, when Andy comes up with his next pitch.
And this one is great fun, and you know, keeping that continuity with Dan Starkey as the reader as well.
Yes, well, you know, I think Dan is such a versatile reader, apart from anything else. So, you know, he's able to handle various regional accents, but also his take on the Eighth Doctor is excellent. And also, you know, he is the reader of James McFarlane's adventures as well. So it's very nice to be able to continue with Dan as the reader for all of these adventures.
Yeah, and again, with an audio continuity with Debbie Darlington keeping things going as well.
Yes, absolutely. Yes. Some lovely sound design in this one. Yeah, I was thinking, for a sound designer, he must approach each new script with trepidation, really, because you never know what's going to be in the mind of the writer, and therefore what you're going to be called upon to illustrate. But Davey rises to the occasion.
Yeah, and gives us that wonderfully sort of brooding, dark theme version as well, which is completely original and new for these audios.
Certainly is, yeah. I think David created that originally for a Big Finish release. I'm not sure, you'd have to ask. Well, it is, as you say, excellent. So yes, we've got a sort of recipe, haven't we, for these, and we've done three, and there will be a further one. I honestly at the moment can't say where it's going to take us to. But yes, a further encounter between the Eighth and James is on the cards.
Fantastic, because it did hint at that at the end, that things were open, because there was me thinking it'd be a trilogy, but it's obviously a trilogy in four parts.
Yeah, and it kind of leaves things with, well, leaves things on a slightly uncertain keel, doesn't it, in terms yes. of the Dr. James's friendship.
Yeah, no spoilers here. We're keeping it secret. No, if you want to find out, go out and buy the release, please, everybody.
Yes. So, yeah, more to come.
Yep. So, okay, so Mike, so the Mummies of Belfast, I'll keep an eye on that for 12 months' time.
Don't joke. Could well be.
Fantastic. Michael, thank you once again.
Thank you, Kenny. Always a pleasure.
A massive thanks to Michael once again for his time. What a lovely man he is. And talking of lovely men...
Me?
No, talking of another lovely man, here's the writer, Andrew Lane.
Oh yes, we will hear from Andy. But also, before we hear from Andy, I just thought, we've just had it revealed by Michael that there's going to be a sequel to this one.
Ooh.
And he doesn't know what monsters are in it. So, shall we find out from Andy what there are?
Yes, we should.
My name is Andrew Lane. Often known as Andy Lane, especially for my older stuff. And I'm the author of, in this particular case, The Teeth of Ice, which is an Eighth Doctor audio for the BBC.
Welcome back, Andy. And of course, that means it's 12 months since you teased us to say that this was coming. You gave us the name, you gave us everything, and that's a scary thought. But at this time of year, it's really good listening, I have to say.
Well, good. I'm glad you enjoyed it. Well, as you know, the first two... Eighth Doctor audios. Your first one's set in Edinburgh, and the second one's set in Cardiff. This one, I wanted to go further abroad, and then I thought, well, I can't go much further than the South Pole, so that's what I did, and it just all seemed to slot into place. And base under siege. I've always loved the idea of a base under siege, so yeah, that's what I wanted to do. I wanted ice. I wanted snow. And I've been reading a lot of 50s and 60s thrillers at the moment. You know, Desmond Bagley and Alastair MacLean and Hammond Innes. And almost all of them are man against the elements. You know, there's some sense that there's a threat, there's an adventure. But and Duncan Kyle as well. And I probably read three or four books in a row that were all set in either at the North Pole or the South Pole. And with the kind of description that makes you think these guys have actually been out there and done it. So I wanted to get some kind of element of that in. And especially you, there's a bit where MacFarlane first arrives in the base, MacReady base. And we can talk about why it's called MacReady base in a minute, if you wish. But he arrives and the base commander tells him to knock all the snow off of his boots as soon as he can, because it's all frozen at the moment. But if now he's in the warm, it'll turn to water, and it'll saturate his boots. And then when he goes outside again, the cold will just get straight through and give him frostbite. And I just love these little details like that, that nobody, you know, these days we don't have to worry about that kind of thing, I don't think. But back in the Victorian day, they did.
I suppose, yeah, if they'd be wearing the likes of leather boots and things like that, and with none of the synthetic polymers and the likes that we have today. So, yeah, I got up to it. I really enjoyed that.
The goggles with the slits in them, because, you know, they hadn't really got shaded glass. I think it was an old Inuit trick to have goggles with just a slit in it to reduce the amount of light coming through.
It's all these details that are fantastic. Now, I did wonder, when you were writing The Code of Flesh, were you aware that you would be doing a sequel to it?
Given The Code of Flesh, it was in itself a sequel to The Scent of Blood. I kind of hoped there was going to be a sequel. So I hadn't been officially told, but there was a kind of general feeling that we should probably keep on going.
I think that's a great thing, having that ongoing series and building up its own mythology within it.
Yeah, and I've left the Doctor and James MacFarlane in a bit of a tricky, not a tricky situation, but and there's a bit of a falling out at the end of The Teeth of Ice, which has got to be resolved.
So you mentioned there the MacReady base. How did that name come about? Where's that from?
You know where it's from. It's actually from the John Carpenter version of The Thing.
Of course it is.
MacReady is the Kurt Russell, the helicopter pilot.
Do you know what? I hadn't put two and two together. And of course it is. Of course it is. Oh, I like it when you do stuff like that.
Well, it's always fun to do that kind of thing, but also you always worry that people are going to say, oh, it's an ice base, it's just a copy of so-and-so. And you think, well, of course, I know it's a copy of so-and-so because I put the reference in, so I'm not trying to fool anybody. You know, I need you to know that I know what I'm doing.
I think it's fair to say that given the amount of books and things that you've written over the years, I think you sort of do, which is good. But I think you really must enjoy sort of building on this dynamic that there is between the Doctor and James, because I think it's sort of the fact that they're able to sort of, they have that partnership when they're acting as a double act now, because they've got that shorthand and familiarity with one another.
Yes. And I just love the idea that McFarlane can just go somewhere. It might 2 years later, you know, he can go somewhere and he go to the end of the earth, go to the South Pole, and he walks into the base and the second person he meets is the Doctor. It's like they're fated to keep on meeting throughout McFarlane's life, and maybe just the Eighth Doctor's this particular regeneration.
I meant to ask previously, when you've been writing for McFarlane, who do you have in your mind as playing him?
That's an interesting question. He's quite fastidious and quite reserved. So in a strange way, I think of him as like Justin Richards, bizarrely. Because, I mean, you've read The Banquo Legacy.
Of course.
Which we shall talk about at some stage. But the way The Banquo Legacy was done, I was writing the police character, and Justin was writing from the point of view of the solicitor. So we kept very much to our own points of view. But when I was writing my policeman, Ian Stratford, looking at his character, John Hopkinson, I was writing Justin as John Hopkinson. And I think some of that's transferred over to James McFarlane. It might just be the kind of Victorian thing of, you know, a bit buttoned up, a bit stiff upper lipped.
Proper gentleman.
Yes.
Just like Justin.
Yes. The kind of person that would, he would take his coat off and put it over a puddle for a lady so she could walk across it. And then he'd make some kind of comment about it as well.
Absolutely. And I take it you'd have done a fair bit of research into all the, you know, like the survival conditions. I mean, all the stuff that you mentioned with, you know, that your ears will freeze up and pretty much fall off if they're exposed for 2 minutes and things like that. I find that fascinating.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a great thing about these thrillers from the 50s and 60s that I've been reading, that, you know, as you're reading it, that these guys were in the Second World War, or the Merchant Navy after the war. They've been all over the world. They've been, you know, if Hammond Innes is writing about a character in a Force 9 gale off the Irish coast, you know he's been there and done that. So I love that kind of veracity and that idea of, if you want to do your research, not that I would, but you know, if you want to do your research properly, you would actually go to an Antarctic base and live there for 6 months and, you know, absorb all of the background. Now, fair enough, for a one-hour Doctor audio, I don't really have enough time in my life to do that kind of research. But and these facts shouldn't be lost either. If you look at Seeds of Doom, which I love, it's one of my favourite stories, but it's all a little bit too easy in some ways. You never really get the impression that they're under severe climactic pressure.
That does make sense. I think the fact you've got the Doctor safe at the end, standing outside with a beach ball and exposed to the elements when they, within minutes, Sarah would have been dead.
Yes.
Yeah.
One of the things I would have liked to have got into The Teeth of Ice, but never got a chance to, was McFarlane actually leaving the base for some reason. And then there's an ice storm and he can't see the base. And he gets completely turned around. He can't work out where he's going, or is he going the right direction, the wrong direction? And how do you... You know, you could be three steps away from safety and warmth, and you wouldn't know.
I think that's one of the lovely details in there, the things that you mentioned, like, you know, like that it takes 3 months for the sun to rise and things like that, or the sun to set and that sort of stuff, and the endless nights. Wonderful, yeah. Wonderful stuff.
That's where the entire plot... Can I give away the plot twist here?
Yes, you can.
Right. It's werewolves, and... that all came about because reading these 50s, 60s books, it's not just that the sun, you know, spends 3 months up and 3 months down, it's that the moon can be up for so long. And if you're a werewolf and you like being a werewolf, you're going to go somewhere where the moon is always full.
I think that was one of the things that really surprised me when listening to it. Sort of like, it's not quite, they might be werewolves, but they're not the werewolves you were expecting.
Yes. in a kind of strange Eighth Doctor sense.
Yeah.
I'm not the doctor you were expecting. Yeah, well, that's what I'm trying to do with these audios is, well, firstly, hark back to the classic Hinchcliffe era of Mummies and Brain of Morbius and Jekyll and Hyde with the Face of Evil. But also, I don't just want to do a vampire story or a Frankenstein story or a werewolf story. I want to twist it somehow so that you go, oh, that's, I hadn't quite thought about it that way before.
Definitely does. I mean, that's two in a row because I was not expecting to get a Frankenstein alike in the Code of the Code of Flesh. So yeah, that's twice you've certainly got me, which absolutely fine by me. I do like to be surprised. Another thing I enjoyed is the whole character of Pentheus Rochdale. What a wonderful name. Where did that come from?
Oh, Rochdale, I can't remember. I think it's just because I imagine him as a big bluff northerner. And so, you know, Rochdale is I'm reliably informed, a place up in the north somewhere.
Or down south for me.
Well, it's true, yes. Yeah, but for me, anything north of the Watford Gap is unknown territory. And yet I'm out of Northerner, as she's just pointed out. You were Welsh the last time I asked.
I'm born and brought up in the north.
You're just trading on every single part of your ancestry.
Anything to not be British.
Pentheus, because I've loved that bizarre Victorian convention that some families would name, just number the kids. Maybe not for the first couple, but I'm trying to think. Septimus is
Septimus
the obvious.
Septimus and Octavius, things like that. Octavian.
Those are the two obvious ones.
Yeah.
And so I thought, well, okay, let's have Pentheus. He's the fifth child, and he's just been child number five. But I imagine, I mean, it's Brian Blessed. I want Brian Blessed to play him. In the film version of this.
I love it. That's pretty much who I had in mind. Listen, dude, that's interesting. That absolutely came across, which was fun. Any particular highlights for you during the writing of this one? Any particular favourite moments?
I just love that whole physicality of McFarlane getting to the base and being briefed and then being told that he's basically got to eat virtually continuously or eat three meals just to keep his carbohydrate intake going. I just love doing the research, and then I love shoving all the research into the piece. And just having McFarlane under pressure from the environment and from what's going on. As usual, the whole thing was just fun to write. I did have a bit of a discussion with the editors of the BBC, because in my original draft, the Doctor sets off the rockets to destroy Rochdale's airship. But the feeling very strongly was the Doctor wouldn't do that kind of thing. And so we agreed that McFarlane would take on the responsibility and do it himself. I guess we're going back to the Doctor doesn't carry a gun idea. But then, you know, I date from the days when the Fifth Doctor would menace Davros with a Dalek gun, and the Sixth Doctor would shoot up the cyber controller with a gun. So I'm not that concerned about the Doctor being the man of peace, effectively. I think there are times when the Doctor just gets pushed too far.
I particularly enjoyed the whole visual image of the airship in Antarctica. I just think that was wonderful. But it's very cinematic, and it's something that I was thinking, have I ever actually seen that in a film, something like that? Because I couldn't think of anything, and I think it's such a good idea, and it's such a strong image.
Somebody's probably going to tell me that an airship wouldn't work in the freezing cold environment. You know, the oil would freeze or something, but I'm going to pretend that that's not going to happen.
Yeah, this is a separate universe.
I can do what I want.
Yeah, exactly. And if it, and even if it doesn't happen to be scientifically possible, the Time War, blame it on the Time War.
Yes. Yeah, I used to have a book, I may still have it on the shelves, of, it's basically a book about Hammer films, but there's a section centre where they've got posters of Hammer films that never actually got made. It was a lot of pre-publicity posters. And they never, one of them was Pterodactyls versus Zeppelins.
You know the one you mean? Brilliant poster.
And that is the, I wish I could have seen that film. So, airships, I've always just loved the idea of them.
Yeah.
I think the first Big Finish I ever listened to was Alan Barnes's
Storm Warning,
which was set on an airship. It was Gareth Thomas, didn't it?
It did indeed, yeah. He was Lord Tamworth. Great story, just so much energy, and I learned an awful lot about the R101, which I'd never heard of to that point, and funnily enough, since then, I've heard about it several times being mentioned over the years, whereas it's one of those ones that never seemed to be talked about in British history, being an absolute disaster. But yeah, fascinating. Absolutely fascinating. You should write it. You should write that into a future one. The Doctor and James could meet dinosaurs.
Zeppelins versus pterodactyls.
Yeah. But you could obviously for the sake of copyright for airships versus pteranodons.
Airships versus stegosaurus. No, hang on a second. No, that's not going to work.
And the T-Rex wouldn't work because its arms are too small. It couldn't reach up.
Yes. I've now got a vision in my brain of the airship coming down too low and the stegosaurus just kind of runs at it and rips the entire bottom of the cabin.
Takes out the gondola type bit, yep.
Yeah.
Instead, this is all yours. I'm not claiming any input into this.
My wife has just had a vision of the Tyrannosaurus Rex trying to operate the controls of the airship, but its arms are too small and can't reach them.
And then it crashes and it kills Adric.
Yes, of course, as everything should. Oh, too soon.
It's only been 42 years, dear, oh dear.
he'll get over it.
Yeah, I'm so glad this is not a surreal conversation. I'm so glad it's completely normal.
Yes.
So, we know there's going to be a sequel. So what can you tease about it? Because obviously the Doctor and James do not part on the best of terms. So
no, they do not part on the best of terms. And I can tell you that the fourth one is going to take place in Galway on the western coast of Ireland.
Lovely.
And it's going to involve possible sightings of a sea monster.
Ooh.
Which is not a Zygon, I'll just tell you that. Sorry, not a Scarisen, I'll tell you that now, okay?
Okay.
And possibly reports of the undead wandering around a village.
I like the sound of that already. I just think there's two things missing, Andy. Dinosaurs and airships.
So true of everything.
That's number five.
When I'm at my mum's house and she's watching EastEnders, I'm thinking to myself, yeah, there's two things that would improve this episode of EastEnders. Do you ever watch Doctors?
Yes, I love Doctors.
Martin Day, who's a long time mate of ours and Doctor Who fan and Doctor Who writer, has written a few episodes of Doctors. And he actually wrote a werewolf episode. I believe it's actually left ambiguous as to whether it's a real werewolf or not. My favourite one, which I haven't seen but I've heard talked about, is the Joe Pasquale episode. Are you aware of this?
I'm not aware of this one.
Right, episode of Doctors where a man comes into the surgery and he's obviously got, he's hallucinating, but his particular hallucination is everybody he sees, he thinks it's Joe Pasquale. And they do seem from his point of view, and they actually get Joe Pasquale to come in and play all the people that he's seeing.
That's just so surreal. I mean, but it's superb, because there was an episode, I think it was Fraser Hines was a guest star, and it was written by Lisa McMullen, obviously a Big Finish regular, and it had a lot of throwaway, you know, like Doctor Who lines in it, your story titles, and oh, this must be some kind of underwater menace and things like that. It was just wonderful lines like that just sneaking their way in. So I do like the subversive when we get that sort of thing dropping in. Made me laugh.
Going back to what you wanted me to talk about, yeah, the fourth one is going to be called the Force of Death.
Ooh, I like that.
Yes. And The Doctor and McFarlane meet accidentally again on the west coast of Ireland, where the Doctor this time is a vet.
I can see that.
Because he's investigating cattle mutilations.
Interesting. Okay, say no more.
Yes,
I want a surprise.
Okay.
Yeah,
it's got to be Dan Starkey because he does such an incredible job.
Every time, he's superb. He's really, really good. I suppose that's the thing. You've got a nice wee production team there who've been consistently doing with David Darlington doing music and Dan doing the reading and obviously working with Michael and produced by Neil Gardner. So you've got that nice wee continuity of a little team all together.
Yeah, and not forgetting the graphic designer as well.
Yes, of course, yeah. Got Minty Design doing the covers.
Yeah. He's a lovely chap, Minty. I've known him for years.
Oh, Andy, thank you so much for taking the time to have a chat. Fantastic. Well, thank you so much, and wishing you and the family a very Merry Christmas.
And you too, Kenny. And I hope someday that we'll talk about the Bancroft legacy.
I think that may just happen. Cheers, Andy.
All right. Take care of yourself. Bye-bye.
So there we go. A fourth part of the story is on the way next year. And we're going to be facing sea monsters, The Walking Dead in Galway. And the Doctor's going to be working investigating cattle mutilations when James meets them. And it's going to be called The Force of Death.
Ooh, I like that.
It's a really good mix. But if there were a hypothetical fifth adventure, where should the setting be and what monster should they face?
Scotland with the Loch Ness Monster.
Oh, okay. A version on the Scarison then. Interesting. Okay. I like it.
What about you? What do you think?
I would like... I was going to say something in the Giant's Causeway, and so that way you sort of had the Republic of Ireland and then we'd have Northern Ireland, but there's about to be an Eighth Doctor story out next month in the Giant's Causeway with Keres and Sontarans and the Eighth Doctor and Charlie. So isn't it weird that I put Keres first just because I'm pals with Conrad? Oh, I don't know, something along those, you know, what monster would I like? Mummies. How about mummies? Let's get some Egyptology in there, and they can be proper real mummies, not just the ones that served Sutek in the Pyramids of Mars. So yeah, that's my thought. Somewhere warm. We definitely need to go somewhere warm after this story here, because the teeth of ice has left my feet feeling really chilly.
I know what you mean. Well, that's us for today. Another story in this wintry weather ticked off. Don't forget to follow us on I Am Refusing to Call It X, Kenny, formerly known as Twitter, as they say in the media. And we've also got our Facebook group too, which you can request to join. So until tomorrow, when we'll be looking at a story set on the 25th of December 2001, when everyone forgot about Christmas, I've been Rebecca Chapman.
And I have been Kenny Smith. And we will see you tomorrow. It's going to be Saturday. Yay, Christmas Eve Eve. Which isn't a thing, but I've just made it up, but it should be.
Christmas Eve Eve, that's terrible.
Oh. Anyway.
Flat bang in the middle of Yule, so just call it Yule, it's fine.
Okay, we'll go for Yule. Woohoo! I should have a drink and have some Yule fuel then. Anyway, this is relevant. Bye-bye, everybody.
Bye.